I'm Colleen McNamara,
and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I want to walk into a cold, bitter ocean to feel the sea.
I have to remind myself, Peyton Davis, whose voice you hear. I got to get her back on the program. She wants us not to be afraid to talk about people that have taken their own lives. She doesn't want to lose her father twice. She lost him once. And maybe the question that you ask when all of a sudden you're confronted with that, rather than saying, oh, I'm sorry for your loss, maybe you say, do you want to talk about him? Or can we talk about him? So anyway, her voice reminds me of that. All right, joining me from, I don't know where, is Bob Nielsen. Robert?
Eastern Shore, Maryland.
Really? The Eastern Shore? Which is the nicest shore, the Eastern or the Western?
Oh, are you kidding me? Not even close to the Eastern Shore.
The Western, I knew it.
We leave that political stuff on the other side.
Oh, is that where it is, on the other side? I thought Annapolis was the home for it, the capital of the state. Yes? No?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The capital of the state, but it's Western Shore.
All right. Just checking. Now, first of all, give us an update. What have you been up to? What's new? And what's going on with 100 entrepreneurs?
Well, we're starting our classes again this fall. We've done one in Walter Reed in Bethesda. We had a good turnout, about 25 people. And then we did one down at Fort Belvoir. And what was interesting, the Wounded Warrior program down there, this is the military version, not the nonprofit.
Okay.
They've actually instituted a program where senior enlisted and officers that are retiring should attend the 100 Entrepreneur class. So we had almost 40 people. And we're talking about franchises and getting franchises and veteran discounts. And we have a tremendous amount of interest. It really went over well. Now we need the Navy and Marine Corps to decide to make their people, when they get medically discharged, to come to the classes.
I still think we need to get the orientation done for spouses. You told me that I needed to cool my jets, so I did. So now I'm blaming you.
I'm not sure what you mean, the orientation.
Well, do you remember we were sitting at lunch with Pat and Patty, and then a couple sat down next to us to our left?
Right.
And then what's Pat and Patty's
dog? Dave Borden and his wife.
Dave Borden.
With the Marine Major sat next to you, yeah.
Right. And then what's Pat and Patty's dog's name?
Wilson.
Wilson. Wilson was getting hungry. Wilson was looking for food. So anyway, but we talked that every spouse learns on their own about.
Oh, yeah. In fact, believe it or not, Pat and Patty are going to Chicago next Monday to talk at the Chicago Institute of Rehabilitation, which was one of the civilian medical facilities he was sent to that did major, major constructive, helpful work on Pat.
Well, wait a minute. What do you mean he was sent to?
Patty went there, found out what they could do, and got the higher-ups in the Army to agree to send him there.
Okay. Patty forced that. It wasn't like
on her own.
On her own. And so my point when you and I were talking was, shouldn't there be an orientation that makes people familiar with VA disability, DOD disability, how this is going to work, as opposed to everybody finding out on their own? And you said, Mac, you need to settle down. I said, what? And you said, you need to settle down. We know people, and we need to think about this. So I'm just reminding you, you said that to me.
That's going to take time, Mac. It's like what they do, what the DOD does for active duty soldiers and Marines right now about what happens when you get discharged. They teach you how to do a resume, maybe.
You know, my son, Patrick's going, just went through that last week, and he thought it was great.
I think it's getting better.
Yeah, I said, so what do you think of it? He said, it's great. I said, what? He said, Dad,
and he might have some good people teaching it.
You know, well, there you have it. So my point is that shouldn't there be an orientation class for families and just to, hey, these are the things.
I think there should be orientation classes for spouses and caregivers before the veterans go overseas.
And you know, to me, Bob, you can even...
Bob is going to scare the shit out of everybody.
Well, I know, but you can... Even if they did a video presentation with a whole bunch of links, and when you were injured or wounded, this gets sent to you, that would at least saying that this is the process, these are the resources, here's contact information. But, you know, and that's why, and the reason that this got brought up again is because your story about Pat and Patty did this on her own.
Yeah, and she'd been doing it for 11 years.
Right.
It still continues.
Right. Right. So, anyway, it's on you.
What happens if you don't have a Patty?
Well, exactly. That's my point. Shouldn't you have an orientation? And you said, yep. Mac, you need to settle down. I said, okay. You're the man. You tell me when we should do it. So, it's on you now. It's now your problem. Who do we go to? And how do we just get an orientation for spouses of people that have been seriously injured and wounded that says, this is the road that you will travel, these are the resources, these are terms, these are people that can help you.
Throw that out on the floor when you and the gunner are down talking.
No, you're the one that told me that you... All right, we're not going to argue about this.
Come on. Pick up some of the load.
I was. You told me to cool my jets. That means you assume the load, since now you're going to govern timing. And once that happens, it's on you to restart it. So anyway.
And the other thing I've been doing, I went to Pat and Patty Horan's after race party for the Army 10 Mile yesterday. It was wonderful.
So, yeah, explain what Pat and Patty do.
Well, as you know, and I think a lot of people know, Pat was shot in the head a little over 11 years ago, major injury. He was a year and a half in bed, couldn't really talk. And through an incredible amount of great medical attention from DOD and from the civilian world, he's made an astounding recovery. But I guess it was 3 years after his injury, he and Patty decided they were going to participate in the Army 10 Miler, which was run at the Pentagon, and there were a whole bunch of patients participating. Pat, of course, because he has difficulty walking, was going to use a hand crank trike, and he did, and they've invited friends of his from high school, college, in the Army, and a whole bunch of family. Pat and Patty have a great big family. And now about 80 people come down to watch the race or go to the party afterwards. And believe it or not, almost 40 friends and family participate in the Army 10 Miler. And they do this, on the first or second Sunday in October at the Pentagon. And then Pat and Patty rent a, pub in Shirlington and have a party there, and they have lunch and everything, and they give out t-shirts, and it's really a great thing. But it's wonderful to see how this becomes a piece of the recovery rehabilitation, because it becomes an objective and a goal that the vet ends up focusing on instead of just sitting there twiddling your thumbs, wasting your time. It's one more thing to fill a piece of that void in your head.
You know, I don't know that you can overestimate that void and how it needs to get filled, because you have to re-engineer. In Pat's case, you re-engineer your whole life.
Well, you're re-engineering your life, and in the case of TBI, you're re-engineering your brain. You're reprogramming it.
Right.
And you know from your sister's situation, the trauma that when you go through an incredible trauma like this, all of a sudden your mind is completely reoriented. You've got to try to get it back on some kind of track. And you watch these vets when they go do these marathons and the Tunnel to Towers run in New York City and a bunch of these other things. The Achilles race team takes them to all these marathons around the country. Getting that challenge in their head and then being able to go out and do it is unbelievable. I sent you some emails the last couple of weeks. Adam Keyes, who's a triple amputee, who was probably one of the longest guys as a patient at Walter Reed, 5.5 years, 6 months after being discharged, goes out and climbs Mount Kilimanjaro a couple of weeks ago. Now, think about that. Triple amputee going up Mount Kilimanjaro.
Yeah, most of us don't do that with two good legs.
I couldn't drive around in a golf cart at the base camp. But the challenge to doing that and then being able to accomplish it, and then a week later, he's out doing a marathon race for the Achilles group in Chicago.
Yeah. No, it's amazing, amazing stuff. The I wanted to have you on, and last week I got an email from a Marine officer, a retired colonel, and he said, Mac, I hear Vietnam veterans say that, you know, we had defeated, you know, the Viet Cong were destroyed, the North Vietnamese army was decimated, and yet we didn't win the war. His point was, yeah, but those were irrelevant points relative to winning the war. He said, Mac, how could we have won that war? You know, he said the answer is we couldn't have. And so it got me to thinking, how could we have won that war? And so I wanted to have you on as the patron saint of all things Vietnam. I wanted to have you on to get your thoughts on that. You've had 50 years to think about it. Is there a way, and when I say winning, I'll define the end state as a political settlement where the Republic of Vietnam, known as South Vietnam, remains intact, its military forces intact, and continues on as a viable nation. So that's my what I would call a peace or victory is the status quo, return to the status quo. Could we have done that? Could that have been done?
In a fashion, but let me preface this by saying the North Vietnamese were looking to win the war politically in the papers and in the press, not necessarily just the battlefield, and the U.S. had their head up their ass about the press. And so it was, the North Vietnamese were fighting it on two different levels, and we were trying to fight it as a military war, similar to World War II.
Okay.
There's a second piece to this. I got there 66, and I was there early 67, but I got there in 66. And I went out on a couple operations early on with 5th Marines, and they were operating between Chu Lai and Tam Kỳ. And I remember being out on one, and God, I guess I'd been there 2 months or 3 months, so it wasn't my first operation. And we were moving kind of an infantry company type thing, and the front elements had realized that just over the ridge in the next valley where we were headed was a platoon of Viet Cong. And because I kind of worked with the infantry company commander, I was cognizant or aware of the conversation going on, and they wanted to get a lot of big airstrikes on this to wipe out, because you never ever saw the Viet Cong in more than just, you know, little small groups.
Right.
So they wanted to blow the shit out of them in the next valley.
Okay.
And they knew there were B-52 strikes going on, and they wanted to get them diverted to drop a load on them.
Okay.
They were advised. I sit here laughing, thinking of this, that request had to go back to the White House, and it would be 24 hours.
Come on.
Well, in 24 hours, those Viet Cong were probably in Laos or Cambodia, or might have even been in Havana. And I remember my eyes were probably about a foot in diameter saying, did I really hear that shit? And some asshole in the goddamn White House, or a handful of assholes, were calling the shots and stuff like that. And now you were in a totally different situation when you were in Iraq and Afghanistan, because you were calling the shots with everything you had in the area of the battle. But, you know, when I heard that story from Riley last week in that goddamn battle where they were 6 hours without air support or artillery support, it turned my stomach because it was the same kind of shit. So what made me think, and I pulled off the side of the road last week when I emailed you an answer, was you can't have goddamn sanctuaries. You can't have sanctuaries over the border in Laos or Cambodia. I don't give a shit what the hell Secretary of Defense McNamara says.
No relation. No relation.
No relation. Please put that in big quotes.
Thank you. After 3 years, please, we finally got that shit straight. Well, but again, those lines were there for a reason, and that was we were afraid that if we pushed the war too far, that the Chinese were going to get involved. So
that's... We got into the war under false pretenses with the Gulf of Tonkin. We didn't know what the fuck we were fighting for. And we didn't know if we won or not.
Hey, did you hear...
And we imposed a whole bunch of goddamn rules that nobody understood that were on the ground doing the fighting.
I know, but you're...
It doesn't make any sense.
I know, but did you hear the...
You don't have me very excited this morning.
I was going to say, I just wrote myself a note. I just wrote down on a piece of paper, holy shit, about the click-off safe. So you're making the case that it's not winnable. But before we talk about winnable...
Hold on.
Did you hear the Stockdale interview that I played where he talks about leading the flight of aircraft and looking for, like, where are these boats that we're supposed to be attacking? They're not here? He's like...
I know it. That got my blood boiling also.
All right. So now that I've succeeded in doing that... Back to, you're telling me, though, that are the all these artificial constraints with the war like that, it wasn't winnable.
Max, know what you're fighting for.
Right.
Know what victory means. Are you prepared to stay in that country for another 30, 40, 50 years like Korea and Europe? Know what the issues are and know what you're going to do. I mean, we did the same goddamn thing again when we went into Iraq, we put that asshole Bremer in charge, and they just banned everything in the country.
Well, you know, I saw Colin Powell on TV over the weekend. I didn't listen to anything he had to say, but I just feel like saying, hey, shut up. You kicked it in the stands. You took that ball of shit to the UN, and you danced to George Bush's tune. We should have never gone to that war, and he was part of it. You're hit the mute button. You're done. I do not want to hear anything that comes out of your mouth about policy or whatever. You, Colin Powell, right? And here's what I was told this by a Marine three-star general, retired, friend of Colin Powell's. We're not going to war. And, you know, Vietnam guys were so proud, right? The only war we had fought in since Vietnam, really, was the Gulf War. And it was like the perfect little war, right?
Oh, great. Yeah.
It was great. It was like, you know, the dumbest ass in the world plops down in the desert, which we've been practicing for about 30 years, right? And with no protection, and lays down in front of us, and just gets the shit knocked out of them, right? And but the legacy of Vietnam is we don't get in these protracted things. And so I called, because I said, this guy that I know, I said, hey, guy, are we going to war? He said, no, Powell's going to keep us out. I said, what do you mean? He said, we shouldn't go to war. You've heard what Zinni says, right? Zinni says there's like 10 priorities in the region. This might be number 8, and you can only fund 4, okay? Not even close. We can contain the Soviet Union, but we can't deal with this shithead? Come on. Like, I'm not sure what's going on here. So you have that stuff going on, but he said, Powell, you know, this is our legacy. Our legacy is not doing this. And supposedly, the president looked at him, and he rolled over. And what's going on, the reason we're there today, is a lack of courage on Colin Powell's part. Now, that's not to say that we would have gone anyway, but...
He was one of about 500 others that were all rolling over for the
right.
administration.
But he was a big, he was our Secretary of State. He was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's a Vietnam
Secretary
veteran. He was a huge guy in all, of that. In all of that. So I don't want to hear what Colin Powell has to say again. Go away.
But going back to Vietnam, if we'd gone into that war without allowing all these sanctuaries, without allowing, you know, a place where they could escape out the back fence and rest and recover and resupply and get all the armaments and ammunition all the time, we probably could have worked out a military solution.
So, and but here's the deal, Bob.
Well, wait, I want another piece. I want to say another piece of this. The local Vietnamese, all they gave a shit about was their next bowl race.
Okay.
They didn't know the difference between communism and democracy. They had no clue. So anything that would have brought peace to them would have been satisfactory. And you could have negotiated a peace, but you had to be all-powerful militarily. But we decided to tie one arm behind our back and put a, you know, a million goddamn troops out there and fight with one arm behind our back. Oh, shit, you're never going to win like that.
The All right, so... According to you, if we say that, look, we'll deal with China, right, if we have to, but we're going to pursue into Cambodia, we're going to pursue into Laos, and we're going to annihilate, right, and occupy the Ho Chi Minh Trail. We're going to cut down.
I would have backed up a month before that decision and said, why are we going into South Vietnam?
Well, we're already there. Okay, we're not. That wasn't the question.
On an advisory basis.
What?
We've been there since the '50s. You're crying out loud with advisors.
Right.
But we had politicians in Washington that said, "Oh man, we're going to make a big stand. It'll be a big show. It'll be a short war. It'll be an easy victory, and it won't cost us much." Sound familiar? You ever hear it? About Iraq and Afghanistan?
I know what you're trying to do. Your blood's boiling, and so now you want to do it to me. And you're sitting there thinking, oh, McNamara thinks I'm the rube here. Well, I'm going to turn him into the rube, and that's the way this shit's going to work. Well, it's not going to work like that, because I'm not going to go for it. Okay, so I'm not going to allow you to say, should we do Vietnam or not? What I'm going to plop you into is 1966, 67, or 68, plot Nielsen. Can you win this thing?
Yes.
Okay. How?
Especially after the Tet Offensive. But part of the problem, Mac, nobody realized back in the U.S., and I was back in the U.S. in 68,
okay,
when the Tet Offensive was going on and when it was right over, how much damage we'd done. Because nobody was reporting that back here.
Okay. All right. So let me ask you this. So I'm going to make you head of MACV, okay? You're also going to be the Secretary of Defense and the President of the United States. You're all of that rolled into one. What do you do to create the circumstances to reach a negotiated settlement with North Vietnam post-Tet? What do you do?
You immediately allow bombing in Laos and Cambodia and wipe out that entire system of resupply that was feeding the entire war.
Okay, so we're going to bomb Cambodia.
And not on 30-day increments or 10-day increments, permanently.
Every night.
We have more than enough armaments to do that.
All right, so we're going to fly, those sorties every night. Are we going to pursue into Laos and Cambodia?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. What else? What about bombing in North Vietnam, and what about blockading North Vietnam?
No sanctuaries anywhere.
So it.
You can bomb anywhere you want where you believe there's an enemy.
Whoa. Okay, and so we're prepared that if China enters this thing, we'll take them on too.
China wasn't going to enter that.
All right.
Read back some of the 1,000-year history of Vietnam and China. Vietnam's been fighting China far longer than they ever fought the U.S.
Okay. What about the port? So in fact, who was telling me? Well, I guess I saw John McCain getting interviewed and him saying, hell, we used to watch the Russian ships going in there and unloading the missiles that were going to shoot at us, and we couldn't touch them.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
So you think all of that?
I think that would have brought a change in attitude on the part of the North Vietnamese.
Okay. Now, here's the next question. Okay.
Be ready to make that commitment.
Okay. So the next question is, you have the President of the United States sitting back, right? In 1968, Nixon gets elected. Tricky Dick. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
I honestly thought he was going to do the best thing to get us out of Vietnam of anybody, and he did.
And he did?
Yeah, he did get us out of Vietnam.
Okay, but we didn't quote unquote win. But you would think it's interesting because most Vietnam guys I talked to say yes, we could have won that war.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have the political will to do that. Okay, so let me ask you this:
We didn't have the political will.
Did not. Okay, so let me ask you this. So in 1968, the country is essentially on fire. Yes. Literally.
Oh, yeah. You got Newark and Detroit and L.A. and they're all burning, D.C. Riots are going on. You know, there's Kent State. All that's going on.
Martin Luther King
was
assassinated.
Vietnam veteran, you couldn't watch the news anymore.
Yeah. Martin Luther King assassinated in April. Bobby Kennedy assassinated in June. So domestically, if you roll the domestic situation up into it, is there any room for it? So if you layer the domestic situation on top of what's on the ground, and I'm looking at this and I'm watching these protests, the largest protests ever in the history of the nation, and then I'm the President of the United States. Okay. I'm Tricky Dick. Tricky Dick was a baseball fan. He's a big Angel fan. He's a little guy too. I didn't realize how small he was. I met him at the ballpark. Yeah. After he got after he resigned, he lived in San Clemente and he would come up and go to the Angel games.
Really?
Yeah, in his limousine, he would come up to the ball game in the second inning so there would be no traffic and nobody would see him. He'd come in the player's entrance, he'd go up to a box and he'd sit and he'd watch the ball game, and then he'd leave in about the eighth, so nobody would see him.
Interesting.
Yeah. So he could get out of his solitude in San Clemente. So anyway, I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at these protests on TV, and I'm saying I'm gonna escalate the war again after the Tet Offensive.
But Matt, the press was not covering the Tet Offensive. The press was busy covering Jane Fonda going to North Vietnam, Curry becoming an anti-war leader of the demonstrations in Washington.
Do you like
all over the press day after day after day?
Do you like John Kerry?
Hardly anything was mentioned that we kicked ass in the Tet Offensive.
Did you like John Kerry?
Hate him.
Hate him?
How the hell can you go fight a goddamn battle like that and then stand up in front of the crowds in D.C. and pull the shit that he pulled? He's a political goddamn sleazebag from day one.
And you're not the most conservative person I've ever met, yes or no?
I'm a liberal. You ought to get my conservative friend to be interviewed.
Okay, so that's from a Vietnam veteran who's a liberal who just said that about John Kerry. Holy shit. Oh, my God. That was classic. So
my wife stuck her head in the bedroom and said, calm down, calm down, calm down.
You and your scream. So the picture, if I'm the President of the United States, I'm looking at all these protests. And I'm looking at this list that you've handed me as a Secretary of Defense and saying, here's where we have to go to get a political solution.
Meanwhile, I got to decide where the B-52 strikes are going to go this afternoon.
Okay, we're not.
And meanwhile, I got to decide, you know, what are we doing?
Stop.
How many more troops do we put
Your wife just told you to calm down, okay? Stop it with that. We're going to pretend like I'm leaving that to you. Okay, I'm going to delegate that to you now that I'm the president. Bob, you drop it wherever you see fit, buddy.
No. Delegate it to somebody on the ground in Vietnam, for Christ's sake.
All right. You can in turn delegate it if you want to.
Delegate it to McNamara Jr., who's running the Combat Action Center.
Oh, my God. All right, so given the domestic situation, I can't do that unless I don't want to get reelected.
Nope. Johnson gave up, decided not to run again.
Right, but so...
When you've made a big bag of shit out of Washington, you leave and retire. Got medical benefits for the rest of your life. You got a great deal.
So, but given the domestic political situation, I couldn't have implemented your solution.
No, by then it was too late. My solution would have had to be implemented early on.
Okay.
That's a Tet Offensive. There was no way we could get out except what we did.
So... because of the domestic political situation, there was no way out except for the way we got out.
And nobody in the U.S. wanted Vietnam.
Yeah, well, I don't agree with that.
Yeah. 200,000 in the Marine Corps maybe wanted it.
No.
Maybe half a million in the Army wanted it.
No, the Marine Corps, no.
Matt, there hadn't been a war since the Korean War.
Yes.
Nobody had any ribbons except for stupid Shirley Highway Defense.
No, they don't get to decide. We're not going there. Okay, what we're talking about, though, is...
Boy, you're cutting off all sorts
exactly,
of territory today.
Exactly.
About dealing with a liberal commentator.
Where is Tim Russert? Right? I was looking for him this weekend. I want to get up and I want to listen to Tim Russert. I don't want to listen to the rest of these shrill shitheads. And
they think they're going to listen to McNamara and Nielsen?
We are infinitely better than they. Trust me.
I bet you don't have 5 listeners right now.
Yes, we do. 85 listeners right now. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Most everybody listens on that podcast. What about, hold on.
I want to have the same interview with you 20 years from now when we're in our next war. And they ask you, how could we have done better in Iraq and Afghanistan?
I would have said, by Colin Powell, doing what he should have done.
Colin Powell's ancient history. He was Civil War.
No, he's not. He was the Secretary of State. Well, even morons like me, we're gonna hear the smoking gun when he goes to the UN, yes? And you,
it was your boy,
you,
Rumsfeld and Cheney.
You sat there and watched it, and you said, "That's it. We're going to war over that."
Yeah, because I hope it was like the first Gulf War. I can watch it on CNN for 6 days, and it'd be over, and it'd be a victory parade. That's what they were all hoping for.
Hasn't worked out like that. And how does he show his face in public? That's what I want to know. Does he not understand that all that is affecting Europe, the destabilization of Europe, is sitting at his feet? Is he going to give
me... the whole refugee comes throughout Europe and the Middle East.
Is he going to give me the Polish salute when he... Mac, what are you talking about? I had nothing to do with that. Like, yeah, it was on your desk, bro. You could have resigned... and said, sorry, I can't take this. I cannot take this thing to the UN. I will not help you take us into a war that we shouldn't have fought.
I bet he's regretted it every day since.
Then just tell him to stay off my TV and somebody get me Tim Russert. So what you're telling me, so when would this have had to have been done prior to 68? So you're talking about sometime during 1966.
66, 67, when we got in and began to see what we were seeing.
So when we begin to...
So in every villager was worried about tomorrow's meal. They weren't worried about who occupied the county, the province.
So let me... Okay, so when we begin to escalate troop numbers, right, that's when we should have looked at the rules of engagement and said, hey, look, if we're going in for a pound, then we have to go occupy the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and we have to be able to pursue into Laos and Cambodia.
For how long?
For as long as it takes to create, and then we're going to blockade Haiphong Harbor, and we're also going to bomb
all the rest of them.
Yeah.
All the rest of them. Hanoi Harbor, all of them.
And we're going to bring this thing to a negotiated settlement. So when we expand the war, we don't expand it in a limited fashion.
Expand it and add more rules of engagement. That's insanity.
And so relative to China, we say China's not doing shit. We said that before, though, like 10 years before that, and China did do shit.
Yeah, they sent a million men into North Korea.
Right.
But they couldn't sustain that for a very long time.
Well, were we rightly to be scared? And
had 300 million other men they could have sent there.
Let me tell you, so, but you're not, in your solution, your assumption is the Chinese aren't coming into Vietnam.
The Chinese have no love for Vietnam. They would do anything to piss off the Americans. And they could do it with the press and all the other ways you do it.
Hmm.
I mean, you even admit today that while China is doing a lot of things, and economically they're very strong, and Grant Newsham will reaffirm that when you talk to him tomorrow, but they still militarily, yeah, they got manpower, but there's a whole lot of things they don't have.
They
do have tremendous manpower.
Okay, the point that I wanted to make about the point I want to make about we needed to go there is when you talk to people, I mean, the domino theory of watching nations fall around the world, it's not people look at it now and they roll their eyes. It wasn't an eye rolling event in the early 60s. It was a no shit Cuba,
Mac,
right?
Mac.
What?
In the 90s, I was in a meeting in Davos, Switzerland, and I was talking to Lee Kuan Yew, the Prime Minister of Singapore. And Lee Kuan Yew is probably the smartest man in Southeast Asia. And he took Singapore from a little trading post to a dictatorship that's an incredible, thriving business arena. And I told him I'd been in the Marine Corps in Vietnam, 66, 67. He looked at me straight in the eye, and he said, you know, you Americans saved Southeast Asia. And the only problem is the only one in the world that doesn't know it are you Americans. Now, this is Lee Kuan Yew, probably the smartest man in Southeast Asia for 25 years. And this was in the 90s. So we really did accomplish a hell of a lot of what we accomplished, but we shouldn't have a military victory like World War II or the first Gulf War. If you look at Vietnam now, we've completely won the goddamn battle economically and financially and business-wise. But you can't measure it the way you measured the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah, but again, when you go back, my point is that the domino theory was real in terms of getting involved in Vietnam.
Lee Kuan Yew believed it.
Right.
Lee Kuan Yew believed it.
Right.
But remember, we went into Vietnam for artificial reasons. The whole goddamn Gulf of Tonkin thing. And how the hell Stockdale kept his sanity being in the prison camp for 8 or 9 years, knowing that the Gulf of Tonkin thing never was real.
Yeah,
they had other priorities to worry about, so.
You dumped that on top of everything else he was worried about? No wonder he didn't go out of his mind, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So your solution is when we begin to escalate troop numbers, we have to take this to a general war. We don't want to invade the North. But we will do everything short of invading the North to include pursuing to Laos and Cambodia, to include occupying the Ho Chi Minh Trail and interdicting it, whatever else we're going to do with it.
You're getting there, Mac. You're learning slowly.
All right, I want to talk to you about post-traumatic winning. Okay, because you are kind of a little bit of an example of it. You seem addicted to being the Grinch.
Addicted to being the Grinch?
Yes.
I'm the nicest guy you've ever met.
You were just, your wife just walked in the room and said, quit yelling. Okay?
She just left. I just heard the car. She just left the house.
Okay, so, well, the Grinch, when he hears the Who people and his heart grows, you seem to have found that when you were in the hospital helping vets get jobs and have never gotten over that experience.
Well, yeah, but there's a background to that, Mac. I got back in 68. I went and spent a career with Turner Construction. I did the usual shit when you get into a career in construction. I worked 14 hours a day. And literally with the international work, you're working 7 days a week. And I travel. I was 180 days a year going around the world to run all this crap. And I basically kept that goddamn cage locked up that your Navy crosswind talks about that holds all the monkeys. Okay.
Right.
The first Gulf War came. I went to the parade in New York when they marched, Trump from Wall Street, and then I went to the parade in Washington, D.C., and I watched Marine veterans with combat ribbons and Purple Hearts getting hugged by the girls and all this thing. It felt great, but the goddamn war had only lasted 2 weeks or longer, but, you know, all practical purposes
right.
when we went into Iraq. So I was really feeling good about stuff, but I never really allowed the box to open about my experience of Vietnam and thinking about it and all that shit. I got to know this buddy of mine who lost a leg in Vietnam, a federal judge named Jack Farley. He and I would talk a lot about this stuff. And separately and independently, we started visiting the wounded 17 years ago. He at Walter Reed and me at Bethesda, and they would compare notes. And what I hadn't realized, I'd go over there, I'd take the metro, I'd go over to Bethesda, I'd talk my way in the gate, I'd go find a Marine warrant officer who was part of Marine liaison, and I'd say, can you get me up on the floor so I can listen to some of these kids today? And what I had learned from Jack Farley is you go in and you listen. You don't tell them stories about what you did. You don't tell them what a great Marine or soldier you were. You listen. And if you listen, they'll open up and they'll tell you anything and everything you can ever imagine. And I would get on the goddamn metro to go back to the Carrollton parking garage, and I'd be bawling my eyes out on the goddamn metro after spending 2 hours at Walter Reed listening. And what I hadn't realized was it was becoming addictive. And instead of going, you know, twice a month, I started going weekly, and then I started going more, and then I started getting money for scholarships, and I started getting vets jobs. But just like listening to what you and the gunner are going through, when you get involved with this, all of a sudden, it was unleashing a whole bunch of hidden monkeys in my mind, but I had a solution to how to deal with it, because I felt, Jesus, if I can prevent one other, two others, five others from having the same issues, I've got an accomplishment. I think I told you the day we were at Walter Reed when we had lunch there, that if I go home at night and had gotten one wounded vet to laugh, I'd hit a home run. And that's what I began to learn and realize.
That's post-traumatic winning. So, you were doing your own version of post-traumatic winning.
Even before you figured out those words.
Yes.
And that's exactly right.
Yes.
And, you know, people have done it with healing waters, teaching them to fly fish.
Right.
People have done it by taking them on skiing adventures. They've done it by taking them. But I found a way that worked for me and the handful of wounded veterans like Pat and Patty Aran and Chris Santiago that helped me with 100 entrepreneurs. If we can help a vet begin to fill that black hole in his brain with something positive, God damn it, we're doing something that ultimately is going to end up surely reducing the odds of suicide. And you got to put some kind of injection in that black hole of something that gives them positive thoughts. And when I listen to the gunner talk on the phone and he's stopping people on the street corner to talk to them about helping them, it's really true. And, you know, whether he likes it or not, he can't stop doing it now.
But, well, you can.
You know, it's all what you're talking about of dealing with the post-traumatic and making it into a positive thing. And how do you take it to help one? Because if you can help one, you can sure as hell help two and three. And, you know, I would have never had the conversation I just had with you 30 minutes ago about Vietnam 10 years ago. I wouldn't have been able to talk about it.
Why not?
But, you know, by being able to go out and do something that I get great satisfaction.
Hey, you just muted your phone, butthead. What the hell? Stand by.
I'm sorry, the person you were trying to reach has a voicemail box that has not been set up yet.
His battery ran out. No, that was his home phone.
Max?
Yes, what happened?
My battery went dead on my phone.
What the hell? You would figure that, like, some big construction wise guy would figure that shit out before he got on the phone. The, all right. Email. He got too excited. Bob just got too worked up and muted his own ass. I love it. That's from the guy in Vacaville.
But we were talking about, you know, winning the post-traumatic battle. And really, by working with and listening to and helping and mentoring the wounded has become my answer solution. And it's far and away the best thing I've ever done.
You know, and it's, that was my epiphany. The win is getting to the point where you're giving.
Exactly.
That's the win. The win is, and giving, a lot of people would tell you, well, that's an act of love, right?
And Jeremiah will tell you this.
But when you're, and that's why, you know, it's interesting, that's why he could never say, when you hear him talk about having to cut back on his own public speaking, you know, and
right.
He, you know, that is, he feels compelled to do that because of the way it makes him feel. But he's also, as he's grown up and become an adult, he's learned how to balance that as he, you know, has become a father and a husband and takes those jobs seriously. But there's always that pull, and it's not an easy pull to say no to. So, but here's my point. So to me, post-traumatic winning is it doesn't take a genius to figure it out. If a guy like me. But that's how you learn to live with that which troubles you your whole life. That's how it becomes a softer landing is in the act of giving. And that's why you couldn't, like, I don't know what kind of barrier you could put up around Bethesda, Walter Reed, to keep Nielsen out. But you wouldn't be able to keep him out until you killed him. Okay.
Because I'll meet him outside the gate with my pizza. But you think about the multiplier effect, Mac. You think about you and the gunner and your hundreds of veteran friends that are reaching out to do something with vets. And I don't care what the hell you do with them. If you take them to a ball game, 100 other things, or you talk to them about trauma, or you do this. All of a sudden, these numbers begin to multiply and multiply and multiply. And, you know, I'm sure we've had over 2,000 wounded vets come to our classes, both at Fort Belvoir and Bethesda. But I can't tell you how many call me back 2, 3, 4 years later, and they're out doing something. or they're helping someone else. It's a complete multiplier. And when you think of all the problems with the suicides and all the other stuff, this is one thing that really works. And, you know, Bouldercrest has put it in one little goddamn fabulous campground, but it works.
And I'll tell you what, and even better, they put it in a book. They put it in an audio book in terms of how they helped you get your hands around how you've changed as a human being. Right.
And Josh Goldberg is one of the smartest guys I know,
right.
And he really knows it and understands it and gets it.
Right. And what you need to understand is, look, you're not a different person. You're, you know, 85% of you is the exact shitty human being that you were before you, you know, before
right.
you went and experienced this stuff. So you've been marginally changed, and you need to be trained to account for, you know, that marginal change.
And that training, the more I thought about it, that's the right word.
Oh, and them choosing it very, very deliberately, right?
As opposed to therapy and that kind of stuff, which all has a medical content.
Right, but I will say this. You know, somebody asked me, well, Mac, what are you going to say when you're giving your pitch if some, like, psychiatrist stands up and says, you think therapy's bullshit, don't you? I know guys like you. And I'd say, no, I don't. Well, it's kind of bullshit, but that's just my personal opinion. Here's what I think.
It works.
Yeah, exactly. There is a percentage of us that have underlying, really significant mental health issues. And for those people, I absolutely believe that the medications are important and necessary, and the talk therapy that you're talking about is important. For the rest of us, and again, this is just me using my 90%, 90% of us, what do we need? We need training on what happened to us, right? We need training on how to manage our lives. So we need training in terms of recognizing our triggers. And then we need to develop wellness techniques, wellness practices that deal with that kind of stuff. And then we need to get the understanding that once you get your hands around that, do not be afraid to help other people, because in that help, you will become the Grinch.
And the reason you and they're going to have immense credibility is because you guys have been there and done that and seen that. Every time I went to Walter Reed, all I ever had to do to talk to the wounded veteran was saying, I'm Bob Nielsen, I was a Marine of Vietnam. And for better or worse, I had instant credibility. They didn't know all the times I was an asshole. But in their mind, they could talk to me. And boy, that just opened the door. And you saw it when we were at Walter Reed. Every time we turned around to talk to another vet, and some had been, you know, discharged 4 or 5 years ago, they'd come over and talk to us like old friends.
Right.
Because they knew they could talk. Right. You weren't going to run and write a report. You weren't going to file something with the command. You weren't going to go over and have them restricted for the weekend. You were just listening to what they had to say. And I believe when you deal with people with trauma, that, to me, is the best medicine in the world. You know, you get your sister on the podcast, holy mackerel.
So, but you figured this out on your own, or you just followed what made...
I stumbled into it, and because I had a buddy, Jack Farley, who had lost a leg in Vietnam, became a federal judge, I had somebody I could talk to find out whether my ideas were completely out of whack or whether it made sense.
Right.
And we just kept going there and listening, and finally he had set up a peer visitor program at Walter Reed where they train new amputees that have been recently wounded to be there as visitors when the really new ones come in from the battlefield. And, you know, they had Vietnam vets, and now we got Iraq and Afghan vets. And when you come in and you first lost a leg or an arm, there's nothing like seeing somebody worse than you getting on with their life. It's great medicine. And he had done that. So it began to work on all of us that shit, there was some real merit to doing this. And what I found is at some point in the rehab process, you can begin to talk about entrepreneurship, you can begin to talk about jobs, you can begin to talk about you know, join an internal construction, go do a whole bunch of things. You can't do it on day one. The kid doesn't want to hear it the week after he lost the leg, but you might be able to do it, you know, on 9 months, a year.
You've been going back there for how many years now?
It'll be 17 years January.
Okay.
3,000 visits.
So when I describe for people, when you stick your hand out and you help somebody, do you still get the same great feeling from that you did?
Oh, yeah. Shit, yes. That's day one. And I don't care what rank they are or what branch of service or male or female. You get the same thing. I've had women amputees that are blown up in Iraq and Afghanistan open up their whole inner soul to you.
So actually, the experience of going to war opens a door for you that you can then use to access and help other people.
It gave me credibility. And
right.
In their mind, very simply, well, this guy isn't going to bullshit me. They didn't know we were going to man the moon, but they at least, in the little formula in their head when they first returned from war, if this guy's been there, he might understand what I'm thinking.
Okay, so final question. When I say that we as veterans need to broaden our lens and not only do this with our own veteran friends and our own veteran community, but also touch the lives of others, does that make sense to you?
Yep, unequivocally. And it's going to make the people you're helping better, but it's going to make you better.
Right. So ultimately, this door that we go through as people that have gone to war, it's ultimately a door to a better place if you seize it.
It's
right?
A stepping stone to a much better place, and you're going to be able to accomplish far more than you ever would have realized. Instead of just getting out and going back to Starbucks to be a barista. It is a door opener both ways, for the person you're helping, but also for you.
It that changes the prism. You know what I'm saying, Bob? So when you hear it like that and says, instead of it being a door into this horrible experience, and obviously there's elements that are horrible. But let me tell you, I don't know if you've looked at it, but when you looked at the interview with Jack Riley, and you see the pictures of those.
Twice. I've listened to it twice.
If you looked at the pictures of those Marines standing around smoking cigarettes, I'm sure it must bring back.
19 years old and not even old enough to smoke.
Right. I'm sure it brought back memories for you. When you see them looking like human beings, you can see that was the time of their lives. Now, interspersed with that is our horrible events. But if you can look at that as a gate, as a doorway to a place where you can then turn around and minister to others, which is what Bob does. He sticks his hands out, and he's there to take them to a better place if they want to go.
And all you got to do is say, tell me what's on your mind. And Riley does it, and look what it's done for him.
Riley's
the guy that did Bravo.
Yeah.
The same thing.
Ken Rogers. No, there are. Anyway.
You talk to Barney Barnum. You know, Barney Barnum's got the added burden of being the Medal of Honor winner. He does it every day, 50 times a day.
Yeah, that's not easy. The Jack Riley interview, if you have not listened to that, go listen to it.
Oh, my God, it's unbelievable.
Vietnam.
And he was in the worst of the worst. I can't even conceive not being a bumbling idiot after that day.
Let me read you an email and then I'll let you go. Vietnam, it was a noble cause ineptly executed by corrupt, cowardly politicians from both sides of the aisle. Who the hell knows what Southeast Asia would look like if we hadn't stood up to the communists? As bad as it was for us, it had to drain the Soviets dearly, and we know they couldn't afford it.
That's what I said. Ultimately, we won.
Ultimately,
that's the incredible part, but nobody in the goddamn United States knows it.
Interesting. Interesting. All right, sir, anything else that you want to get off your chest in this third?
Well, you really started my Monday off on the right foot. my pulse is about 165 right now.
Before.
My blood pressure is probably 330 over 200, so I'm off to a great roll.
Go do some yoga. Go find a labyrinth.
Great talking, Matt, always.
All right, thank you, sir.
Hey, who's going to win the World Series?
If I were a betting man today, I would say the Houston Astros.
Not the Yankees, huh?
Well, I think the Yankees are going to beat the Red Sox. I think Houston's starting pitching is still the best in baseball. I think the Dodgers-Braves series got good last night. It'll be interesting to see what happens because the Dodgers are kind of a fragile team. But they should be the National League winner, and I would say Houston beats them again. They're just too good.
So,
what about you? Who do you think?
Well, I like the Nationals, but since they're picking up garbage in various cities around the country this week, I thought Boston was going to go all the way, but I think the Yankees will pull something coming together. But Houston looks like the team of the century, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be a great player. I just wish they wouldn't do all the playoffs at 9 o'clock at night. Be up to 2 in the morning on the East Coast.
Well, that's too bad. That's what you get for living on the East Coast.
No, it's all you goddamn guys that had careers in baseball. You know, all you concentrated on was money. You didn't give a shit about the fans.
Well, here we go. All right. Wait, there was one more thing I was going to say. Yeah, I forgot. It must have been a lie. All right, sir. Have a good one. Thank you.
And get Grant Newsom on.
Yeah, he's coming on tomorrow.
Take care.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Uh-huh. That is the patron saint of All Marine Radio, Bob Nielsen. Bob, I don't want to give him too much credit, but he envisioned this. Talking about it would lead to good things. He envisioned this. And he's not that smart either. That's the killer. All right, we'll take a break. More of All Marine Radio coming up on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it, the McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.